Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. People who are testifying aren't quite here except for one person, so I'm going to open his bill first, which is 2946. Mm-hmm. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2946.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2946 repeals the prohibition sunset that was established in 2010 in House Bill 3665 against dental services contract restricting prices charged by a provider for services not covered by the contract. There's no expenditure on the bill, no revenue impact on the bill. Left the House floor, 59 ayes, 1 excused. It was on the consent calendar.
Great. Mr. Okulich.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. Just for background, in 2010, the Oregon Dental Association introduced House Bill 3665, a bill to prevent dental insurance carriers from capping fees on non-covered services. Previously, a non-covered service provision contractually capped the fees that participating dentists may charge beneficiaries for the treatment, even though the plan didn't provide coverage or share risk. So, you know, a plan may, you know, include sort of removing cavities, but doesn't include like teeth whitening. But they would sort of tell us what we could charge for that. It was a bill, like I said, in the 2010 session. It passed through the House and the Senate unanimously. But one of the concerns that was brought up was because that was a three-week session, you know, they thought it would be a good idea to just put a sunset on it. Sorry. Like I said, this bill was unanimous in the House. It was on the consent calendar. We've talked to the insurance companies. We've sort of given them a heads up on it. At this point, we haven't heard any opposition. Since we passed it in 2010, there's 30 of the states now, you know, cover it. So we'd ask you to support House Bill 2946.
Simple bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's going to take me about 50 minutes to read this long bill, so.
All right.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah, and thank you for coming. I've had a couple of, even a constituent of mine, actually my opponent, who came to lobby for this. So I think, at least I am very much in favor of this. All right, I will close public hearing House Bill 2946 and open a work session, House Bill 2946.
I'm sure I move House Bill 2946 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2946 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
excused.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monson.
Aye. Motion carries, and you want to carry it?
Oh, sure.
Oh, Senator Cruz will carry the bill. All right. I will close the work session on House Bill 2946 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3345A. Representative Hoyle.
Good afternoon. Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. And today I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3345, affectionately known as the Body Parts Bill. So this is a bill that provides some oversight of for-profit non-transplant anatomical research organizations. So these are companies who, in return for offering to pay for cremation or burial, then are able to use those bodies in research. So there was some concern that we would like to have some consumer protection. And also, we want to ensure that there's oversight so that the remaining remains of the body, once the research is done, are treated in a respectful manner, which is different than how you would treat medical waste. So this would put the for-profit non-transplant anatomical research organizations under the authority of the Oregon Health Authority, and they'll provide certification requirements. We worked with all the groups that are interested. When I was a freshman, the good chair of the health committee put me on a work group and said, figure this out. So we got everyone to come together. We got agreement. You have the dash A-10s in front of you, which do two things. And I believe that Craig Campbell from the Hospital Association will speak to some of the language. We also will be sending you a dash 11 that will take out line 19. We just got that amendment, so you'll see that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you. It's a little bit technical, but again, this was out of an interest to ensure that you have consumer protections for consumers. So there's clarity when someone says that they will pay for a burial or cremation, under what circumstances people would be paid for that, and also who has ownership of the body or body parts and how those body parts would be treated. So happy to answer any questions, or you can wait for the certified smart people to come up and ask them.
Senator Cruz wants to ask you a question.
Yes. Representative Hall, you've been working on this since way back when you were a freshman, all that long ago.
It was a very long time ago. Yeah. You know, good year and a half.
All right. Thank you. We want to respect Representative Barnhart's time, so we're going to temporarily close this and then let the rest of your certified smart people talk.
And I'm going to go down to rules, and I thank you very much for your consideration.
Yes, thank you, Representative Hoyle. With that, I'll temporarily close House Bill 3345 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2385.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. This bill it looks like a huge bill, but it actually contains only one small provision and then an enabling clause at the end, and that is that on line 20 on page 2, the screening interview or treatment program under ORS 813.021 is removed from the provision that exempts this whole list of things from coverage under group health insurance policies. The reason this bill has come up is because we're dealing with the situation in which a person's alcohol or drug addiction difficulty is discovered as a result of traffic infraction or criminal activity. Usually we're talking about driving under the influence charge. And typically what happens for drug and alcohol treatment programs that work with alcohol diversion programs or DOI diversion programs is that the issue arises in a public way, at least, for the very first time when someone is arrested for driving under the influence and then is referred for a diversion. The problem that leads to this bill is that there are many people who are required to pay for the treatment program and diversion programs who have health insurance that, under the normal course of events, would be covered under the addiction, chemical dependency, and for mental and nervous conditions provisions of this statute, but for this clause that's being removed. And the result of that is that many people who need to be treated when they're embarrassed, when their driving privileges are in abeyance, when it's very public that they have a problem, instead delay treatment for financial reasons. So the point of this bill is to get people into treatment, to get them evaluated quickly, to determine which people actually are drug addicts or alcoholics and need specialized treatment, which ones can be handled through an educational program instead, and then get them into that treatment program and get them on through it to hopefully better outcome. The result of doing that would improve public safety, decreases the likelihood of ongoing problems for the person who is being treated. And what happens currently is that we have too many people who are delaying going into treatment, reducing their likelihood of success, and actually reducing the kinds of outcomes that we need, hence this bill. What brought me involved into this situation is that I'm the president of Addiction Counseling Education Services in Lane County. I've been a member of the board for, I think almost 20 years now. Is that right? Anyway, long time. And this has been one of those issues that has come up since this bill was originally passed. Some insurance companies currently ignore the exception that's in this statute now and pay the cost that is charged, and others don't. And the result of that is that some people simply don't get the treatment they need in a timely fashion. And that's the purpose of it. Passed the House, I think, fairly handily, if I remember correctly, and I would commend it to the committee.
Great. I agree wholeheartedly in this concept. I feel that if you are covered by insurance and you need to go into drug treatment, that your insurance should be able to cover it. The problem is this may be considered a new mandate, and therefore, if it's a new mandate, the state, through general funds, would have to cover that. And so we will hear the insurers talking to us about that, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention because this was just brought to my attention yesterday and this morning. Mm-hmm. Not yesterday, but I guess both of them were brought to my attention today. So I just want you to know that there are some concerns.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate knowing that. That's the first time I've heard that particular argument. Insurers have made a number of other arguments in opposition to this bill, but I haven't heard that particular one before. Of course, the legislature routinely establishes mandates for group health insurance policies, and the treatment for chemical dependency and mental and nervous conditions already is required under group health insurance policies. This simply provides an exception when the reason for the referral is that a person was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. And I would ask the chair and the committee to be absolutely certain that, in fact, this somehow or another relates to a state budget issue, because I don't see that being the case.
Yes. Senator Shields.
Senator.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Senator.
Senator Shields. I said Senator Shields.
Thank you. do you have a sense of, you said there were some insurance carriers who were regularly covering this. Do you feel comfortable sharing who, in your view, are those actors?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. I would love to do that, but I can't because I don't have the names.
Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
I just want to make sure I understand your question, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that for public insurance programs, like for Medicaid, that those are the ones where the state would have to cover them if they were mandated after 2012. But would you think this would qualify as the kind of essential health benefit that we would have to?
Mm-hmm. Under the Accountable Care Act, we have used Pacific Source, and I'm not sure as, you know, whatever, we use Pacific Source as our basic essential benefits plan. And I don't know the particulars of that, of what is covered, but if that is not covered, and I've been told that it's not covered in the essential benefits package, then the state would be held liable to cover those claims.
Madam Chair, I may have the answer to your question. I have an email, which I'd be happy to share with the committee, from Brian Niebert, the legislative coordinator for the health care programs of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm not sure what the date was on it. March 27th, which says, to Representative Greenlick, as promised, I wanted to follow up this afternoon's committee hearing on this bill. The reason the bill has minimal fiscal impact on PEB and OEB is twofold. First, PEB and OEB are currently cover treatment, so that is a partial answer to Senator Shields' question. Second, in analyzing the impact, the requirement to cover screening costs, PEB and OEB staff looked at the most recent record, 2008, for a rate of DUII offenses in Oregon, which is 0.65%. Applying this rate to the number of individuals covered by PEB and OEB at the cost of $150 per offense results in an amount which would be too small to impact premiums, thus making the fiscal impact negligible. Hope this answers the question raised during the hearing. Please do not hesitate to let me know if there's any other information we can provide, and that's signed by Brian.
Could we have a copy
Niebuhr
of that?
And I will certainly provide mm-hmm. that to the committee. I'm not certain that this deals with the specific question the chair is raising, but I think it's at least a piece of it.
It's a piece. All right. Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you,
thank you
very
Madam
much,
Chair.
Representative Barnhart. And do I see? Yes, Representative Boone. Yeah.
Okay.
So I will temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2385 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3244A. Representative Boone.
Do you want me to read? Do I have two?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3244 directs the Department of Human Services to recommend policies to integrate the system of services and support for runaway and homeless youth who are 0 through 17 years of age and for youth who are 18 through 20 years of age who continue to be or who become homeless. It authorizes DHS to enter into those contracts with providers of services to the youth who are 18 to 20 and continue to be or who become homeless. This left the floor with 60 aye vote. Minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Great. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I am merely the vehicle for this bill. I have two very able colleagues with me today who will explain the details of this and answer your detailed questions and hardball questions. But this bill basically extends the age of a homeless and runaway youth from 18 to 21, up to 21 years of age. So they don't just get turned out onto the street on their 18th birthday, which is what was happening before. Because at that age, especially with the issues that they deal with in so many cases, they're not mature enough and they don't have the skills to live a successful life. And this helps them get the services they need, keeps them in school if possible, helps them get work. I like to say they go to school, which is probably the best for them and everybody else, but it gives them the support they need to make it through that next important transition to adult life. And as you will hear, it doesn't cost us any more money, and it doesn't dilute the program as it is now, but I'm going to let Janet and Mike explain that a little bit in more detail for you.
Great.
Thank you very much, Janet Ahrens, the Executive Director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. Thank you for holding a hearing on this subject. We're very happy to bring this forward to you. The Oregon Commission on Children and Families originally housed Oregon's runaway and homeless system, and when it was apparent that they were going to be moving on to other pastures, introduced a bill last session that would move the bill over to the state's child welfare system. The reason that we wanted it in the child welfare system is because the kinds of outcomes and the kinds of needs that that system meets for foster children is the same as those for runaway and homeless youth, and that's safety, well-being, permanency, and self-sufficiency. Those are also the same objectives that the Children's Bureau at the federal level has for children in foster care, and which they also combine in their portfolio with runaway and homeless youth. This particular bill focuses on homeless youth between age 18 and expands it to age 21. The system that exists in the Department of Human Services, their role is to build the statewide system, to continue to develop it. And the best way for us to do that would be to make the age up to 21 consistent both with the federal work that's done for child welfare and for runaway homeless youth, and also add that age of homeless youth to child welfare, which is the same age range that they continue to serve foster children. So that's the short of it, and Mike Balter is a runaway and homeless provider and can answer some specific questions and give you some more information.
My name, for the record, is Mike Balter. I'm president and CEO of Boys and Girls Aid. I've handed out to you some of the details of a program that we operate in Washington County. I think you've heard probably enough about our goal in this age change, and probably release the time for questions.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Representative Boone, I'm trying to figure out how this is connected to C4 mapping, but I can't really.
Oh, I have you so well trained.
No, we have done some really good things, I think, for our foster children once they turn 18, but haven't really focused on our runaway and homeless, dealing with that aspect. This is strictly for those who are homeless, correct?
Correct.
Yes. There's, yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
I think Representative Boone knows this, but you two may not. I have a bill, Senate Bill 450, that will be establishing a task force to start to think about how we really do even better coordination of safety net services. And I would be extremely grateful if you get in touch with my office just to let them know of your role in serving this population, because we'll be wanting to get information from you as part of that. So thank you in advance for your help.
In meeting with my school districts, they are saying there's a greater growing number of homeless in the school system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a huge problem.
Really, really a problem, yeah. All right. Well, you have it easy. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3244A and open a work session on House Bill 3244A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3244A to the Senate floor to due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3244A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hewitt?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Shields? Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman Lundin?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will carry the bill. Excuse me. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3244A. And colleagues, we're not going to be hearing 2101B. We don't have the paperwork that was scheduled for a work session. So that is taken off the agenda and moved to the next Monday on May 20th. I will open a public hearing, go back to, let's start at the top, House Bill 2385. Sandy, do you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you just heard from Representative Barnhart. Senate Bill 2385 removes the exemptions from treatment resulting from conviction of driving under the influence from health insurance coverage requirements for chemical dependency and mental or nervous conditions, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact, left the House floor, 40 ayes, 19 nays, and one excused.
All right, let's call Dr. Chris Ferrantino and Jonathan Eames.
Good afternoon. So my name is Chris Ferrantinos, and I'm a psychiatrist and a specialist in addictions. I work for DePaul Treatment Centers, and I have been working with individuals who get DUIs for about 20-plus years. Insurance companies should not be able to refuse paying for addictions treatment for a person who gets a DUII, because this hurts many individuals in need of addiction treatment, and also the employers who are paying for the insurance premiums and don't see the care delivered. To give you an idea of our population, 80% of the individuals who enter our treatment program meet the DSM-4, now DSM-5, medical criteria for substance use disorder.
And what percent did you say?
80%. So, and this is just DePaul. I mean, I'm just talking about my experience. But 80% meet that criteria, and 20% meet the dependence criteria, which is the highest criteria of people. They're really very sick. Many people enter addictions treatment through the court system, and the majority of them truly need treatment, quite frankly. People don't walk in and say, I want to be treated for this. At our agency, we see individuals who have insurance, have a DUII, but have to pay for treatment because the insurance does not cover. And that's not true for every single insurance carrier, but it's true for some because they have the possibility of not paying. and they end up dropping out because they cannot afford it. These individuals end up back in the court, get a conviction, and go down a path of moral societal consequences and costs. Their families suffer, employers, and the individual, of course. In addition, treatment for addiction works as well as any other treatment for chronic conditions. And alcohol and drug problems, it's recognized as a chronic relapsing condition that responds just as well as asthma treatment or diabetes treatment to treatment. So people reduce drinking and stop drinking every day. So I'm here to really defend and ask that you consider voting for House Bill 2385 and support insurance not discriminating against court mandated treatment. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, also known as OPRA, which is the statewide association of alcohol and drug residential treatment facilities, of which DePaul is a member. And I think Dr. Ferrantino actually eloquently stated what we're trying to solve here. You know, last week or a week and a half ago in your committee unanimously passed out a bill which recognized addiction as a disease. And I think that's a first big step, is to recognize this as a disease just as you would any other type of disease and have it treated just like any other type of disease. A lot of folks think that addiction and addiction issues are just simply a choice, and that there's not an inherent medical underlying condition that is being treated when you go to a treatment center, that you just made a mistake, and that you're not, you know, this is not something that should be on the same level as diabetes or other chronic diseases. What this bill does is that it removed that one little prohibition that insurers don't have to pay for. Even if you have been paying your insurance premium, your employer expects that you will be treated for this because maybe they've been participating in paying the premium, and it removes that exemption so that insurance does pay for it, that you what you have been paying for, and just because you got it because you had a DUI doesn't mean that you shouldn't have this covered by your insurance company when you need the treatment, just as you would if you would need diabetes treatment or you break an arm. So we hope that you pass this bill. This is a very good bill, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Well, what I would like for you to do is to stay. Let's hear from the opponents of the bill.
You bet.
And then
there's opponents.
We may call you back up to try to solve this issue, as you heard when I was asking Barnhart or letting him know the concern.
You bet. We're already running down that question right now. So.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I must say, nobody can fill a room like my committee on opponents on insurance bills.
All right, Elise Brown and Tom Holt.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and I'm here respectfully in opposition to House Bill 2385, which, to be really clear, mandates private insurance pay for court-ordered treatment resulting from driving under the influence of intoxicants, or DUII. AHIP and its members oppose the bill for two reasons. Under current law, health insurers are required to pay for services as part of substance abuse or mental health treatment. However, the coverage is explicitly excludes treatment that is ordered by the court as part of restitution for DUII. Further, the state law provides that a court may order DUII offenders to complete a sentence while at a treatment center, and mandates that the person pay for the treatment, which the person is referred to. That's coming from correction statutes, and I can cite those for you if you like. Number two, and even more concerning for the consideration of this committee, is how to pay for this, because we'll explain that this is a new mandated benefit. We are not required to pay for it now, so this is a new mandated benefit that would require the state to appropriate money for all individual purchasers that obtain coverage through Cover Oregon. ACA requires that the states must defray the cost of any required additional benefits, and this would be one of them, over and above the essential health benefit. A&D treatment for DUII offenders is not part of the benchmark plan. If this legislature feels the desire and need to pass this bill, you're going to need to look for money to fund it. And I just wanted to point those out to you clearly and answer questions after Tom's testimony. Thank you.
Chair Moss, Anderson, members of the committee, Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm going to focus on the mandate issue, but just one point around the policy of it. My friend Mr. Eames said that people will have paid for this benefit at the time that they're ordered by the court. That's not correct. Our contracts, per the law, exclude coverage for DUII court-ordered treatment, so that is not factored into their premium, and it's one of the many things that can be excluded from a contract, depending on what a group has chosen to do in the large group case, or depending on what's allowed under the law with our regulated products in the individual and small group market. Now, I want to take a minute and just kind of connect the dots here on the mandate piece and how this works. One, the ACA has provisions in it that, one, define what constitutes a mandate and then what do you do about it. And the question is, you know, why did, you know, Congress choose to do this? One, they define a mandate under the ACA as being coverage or the offer of health insurance coverage for specific health services or specific diseases, and it goes on with some other language. But this, so does this bill meet that test? Well, yes, it does, because we have an exclusion specifically in Oregon law that court-ordered chemical dependency treatment as a result of a DUII conviction. That's an excluded service, and this bill would mandate coverage for that service. So it makes it a mandate under the ACA. So then what? Well, the ACA elsewhere says that while the state may require that a qualified health plan offered in a state offer benefits in addition to the essential health benefits, the state must assume cost. And I'm reading from the Act here. A state shall make payments to or on behalf of an individual eligible for the premium tax credit under Section 36B and so on. It has some other cross citations. But bottom line says has to defray the cost of the covered service. Just last week, CMS issued additional guidance on this question of what about qualified health plans and the costs outside exchanges. There have been some question of whether or not this rule applies for products sold outside exchanges as well as inside. And the answer is pretty clear. It was in a Q&A that came from CMS. And the question is, will states be required to defray the costs that qualified health plans sold outside marketplaces, which is how the feds refer to exchanges, incur meeting state benefits mandates as they're required to do to have those mandates be required, and sorry, this is a little bit jumbled, but that's their writing, not mine, be required of QHPs sold through the marketplace. And the answer says, after some statutory citations, this definition requires that the QHP have, in effect, a certification issued or recognized by each marketplace through which such plan is offered. The requirement to defray the cost of additional benefits applies to all QHPs, including QHPs offered outside the marketplace, and I'd be happy to provide the committee with a copy of that. So it's very clear because the state would, through this bill, be requiring coverage for a service that is not now covered and is in fact explicitly excluded, the state would be obliged to pay for that somehow. We don't have a mechanism yet in Oregon to handle that. This is new territory. So some mechanics that would be necessary to implement this bill. One, we need to establish some kind of mechanism for tracking cases and to be able to, we don't know who we would send the bill to for it. We can track claims, but then what? It would be good to know, given that this is going to have a significant fiscal, I would assume, how many cases there are. I haven't heard testimony yet about how many cases actually are concerned here. And it would probably be good to know the repeat rate, which would get you to some idea of what the overall impact is. We do provide coverage for chemical dependency treatment outside of the court system when members have that as part of their coverage. Of course we pay for that. We also have experience that indicates that, you know, most people don't succeed the first time around, so it'll be or many people don't succeed at the first time around, so it'll be good to know what that repeat rate is in order to come up with an overall cost with the cases. But I think this definitely is something that needs to have a fiscal look at it over and above the policy issues. We didn't write the ACA, but that is the law of the land. I think Congress probably put that provision in because in the world of states being able to secure subsidies for citizens through exchange coverage, the feds wanted to cover their side of the ledger of not having states enact new mandates that would, you know, bring additional costs upon the federal fisc without having some look at the balance of that. You know, if in the legislature's wisdom, this is something that you wish to have covered, that's a policy decision. But what's not in any of our hands is the fact that the state would be liable for that decision in a financial sense. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
See, I don't see it as a new mandate, but then I can't, you know, interpret what it comes down to. I mean, the essential benefits package does cover drug and treatment, drug and alcohol treatment. And so, therefore, someone who is being referred, to me, it's not a new mandate. You have in your contracts that you will not cover someone who has committed an offense. So that's another issue. I'm just focusing on the fact that in the essential benefits package, they already are covered. So I would like to have you, enlighten us on that aspect of it.
Chair Moss Anderson, what the bill does is require coverage for a specific type of this service, and that is service ordered by the court. And that makes it a new service under the ACA. Yes, we provide coverage in general under our contracts for chemical dependency treatment, but we do not provide coverage for treatment ordered by a court. There's a policy reason behind that, in that a court order may have nothing to do with medical assessment of any kind. It can be part of a plea bargain. There can be other factors besides medical need. That's how we, I think, got to this place historically. But the fact remains that it is a service not now covered, that is now excluded under state law, or may be excluded under state law. And the bill would make it a required service. And because the ACA declares that any additional service, specific service, becomes a mandate under the ACA subject to, you know, state fiscal responsibility. That's what gets us there.
We've had
this issue on some other bills as well, as you know, on the autism ABA bill. We have the very same issue, and we've proposed that the state find a way to pay for that.
It would be very important to me to have the health authority give us their opinion, as well as Cover Oregon, to give us their opinion on I know what your opinion is. Because to me, when we went through from the transformation, we truly do believe that alcohol and drug prevention will save us millions of dollars in the long run by addressing them early on. And, you know, it's just a philosophical point of view that I know that drug and alcohol treatment does work. Yes, many have to go through it many times, but others don't. So I don't see the health authority here to tell us, but we would like to have their input on that. Are there comments?
I do. I have some questions, but I think hearing from the Oregon Health Authority would be useful. I certainly understand your point of view, but I do want to get to, is this opinion or fact? And I'd like to hear a second. Mm-hmm.
Other comments? No. All right. Jonathan, do you need to reply? You realize the issue here. We aren't going to move the bill today. We just need to get more information. All right. Thank you so much, panel. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, yes. Can I just make one comment? I think the policy issue before us is an important one because I think very few people enter treatment without a catalyst. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, are we going to cover treatment at DePaul Treatment Center or are we going to cover it at, you know, the Rolling Hills confines of, you know, a Hazelden outfit where somebody checked themselves in voluntarily? And I think it's a policy decision that's very important because the state's paying for it one way or another.
Right. Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I could add one other comment. I mean, the comment about people not succeeding with treatment, if I had to count on my fingers and toes the number of my patients who have diabetes who didn't succeed with lifestyle modification the first time I educated them about it and they went to diabetes education and the second and the third and the fourth time, mm-hmm. I don't see much difference, frankly. It is very, very tough to make substantive changes, especially when you're dealing with a disease like addiction. And I understand, but if the person were checking themselves in repeatedly to Hazelden, as Senator Shields mentioned, then the treatment would be covered. And just because it's not going to succeed the first time does not strike me as rationale for not paying for it. I agree with Senator Shields' point about the catalyst necessary.
Am I allowed to say something?
Yes, please. A
couple of points. One is the fact that
Say your name again for the record.
Chris Ferentinos from DePaul Treatment Centers. Right now, Oregon Health Plan, most of the plans that we work with already recognize that if there is a medical necessity, they will pay for it. In addition to that, several plans that are commercial have also recognized that, and they pay on their own. When we dispute, they decide to pay for it. Therefore, there's already some ambivalence in denying, and I think that's your point that you're making. I just looked here that in 2008 there were 17,000 arrests for DUII in Oregon, and many of them are already receiving treatment. So we're not talking about a huge number of people, but certainly people that get affected by the fact that they cannot access their benefits. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2385 and open a, did we do this one?
Yeah. And we did this one.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 3345A. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3345, you just heard from Representative Hoyle, but this bill provides for regulation of persons that engage in the recovery or distribution of anatomical material from donors for research and or education purposed other than transplanting anatomical material or therapy, continuously appropriates money to the Oregon Health Authority for the purposes of the Act, declares an emergency effective on passage. You have the A-10 amendments that Representative Hoyle did mention that there needs to be a correction to the 10s. Which will be submitted after the meeting.
She said the dash 11s, no?
She's thinking that the 10s will become the 11s.
Oh, okay.
But we don't have the
11s
yet.
All right.
There is minimal fiscal impact on the A and gross, no revenue impact at this time. The House floor vote was 52 ayes and 8 noes.
All right. Craig, do you start this off? Craig, and then, okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Hospitals and Health Systems Association in support of either the Dash 9s or the Dash 10s or the adjustments that are made to the Dash 10s. Our concern really is dealt with in the two that you already have and the one that you're likely to get, the Dash 11s, in that the concern coming out of the House was that hospitals were taken care of, healthcare facilities were taken care of, but labs that do research and education weren't, because they don't fall cleanly under either of those definitions. It was something that was just trouble getting the right drafting in, and the Dash 9s and the Dash 10s both take care of those problems. We anticipate that that will also be taken care of in the Dash 11s. And that's really the only issue that that I needed to speak to. Other than that, we're fine with the bill as it is.
Thank you very much. Hasina Squires and Wally Ordman and Steve Wells.
Craig, this is for the hospitals. How many lobbies those guys have?
One of them four times.
Do you want to go first, Wally? Or? Okay. Hi, good afternoon. Members of the committee, Chair Mona Sanderson, and members of the Senate Health Committee, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of two companies that are located in Senator Mona Sanderson's district, MedCure and BioGift. The two firms that I represent are will be characterized as non-transplant anatomical research and recovery organizations, or as Representative Hoyle likes to describe them, as body parts companies. this bill is the genesis of a bill from last legislative session, which was not successfully passed, and a great deal of work has gone on and during the interim and during this legislative session to work the language of House Bill 3345 into what became the A engrossed version. And I'd just like to run through a little bit further in detail what the A engrossed version does. So there are two non-transplant anatomical recovery and research organizations in the state of Oregon, as I've expressed, and they will both be required to be licensed by the Oregon Health Authority. They will be required to be accredited by an entity that the Oregon Health Authority certifies as an accrediting agency. And in order to be an accrediting agency, you have to have a whole series of things that you do as an accrediting agency and require of these two companies. One is documenting handling of materials, retaining records for a 10-year period, allowing for on-site inspection of facilities. A fee will be adopted in statute via passage of this legislation of $1,750. That license will expire every 2 years. The two companies will be required to keep a record of donors and who has had possession of the material. There will be disclosure to the next of kin about what portion of the body is being returned, whether it be all of the body or a portion of the body. Proper disposal of unreturned remains will be required, which we already currently comply with. We comply with all of the things that are currently in the bill already. There will be a clear notice of transport costs and disposal of anatomical remains, and then the bill provides for civil penalties. We support the bill with what should be the forthcoming Dash 11 amendments. The Dash 10s had one additional sentence, which we didn't expect to see, and so we're anxious to see the Dash 11 amendments. And with that, I'll turn it over to Steve Wells, who's the operations manager for BioGift, and I'll tell you a little more.
Good afternoon, members of the Senate Health Care Committee. For the record, my name is Steve Wells, and I am the operations manager for BioGift. BioGift Anatomical is a whole-body, non-transplant, anatomical donation company. We launched on January 1st, 2003 in Tigard and relocated to Portland in December 2006. BioGift currently employs five individuals. Our purpose is to advance medical sciences through education and research. BioGift provides fresh, frozen anatomical specimens to respected academic, government, corporate, and continuing education cadaver training programs. Most medical students do not have the opportunity to perform surgery until serving their fellowship. Academic programs like New York University, Harvard University, and Cornell Medical College acquire specimens from us to allow those third and fourth year residents to perform surgery prior to serving their fellowship. They will perform general, orthopedic, gynecology, neurologic, and minimally invasive surgeries. Organizations like the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons, American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and American Association of Gynecologic and Laparoscopists hold courses for surgeons to obtain the necessary continuing education credits that they are required to complete each year. They use our specimens to teach various surgical techniques to those who participate. We work with companies including Boston Scientific, ConMed, Cook Medical, and Stryker to further the research and development of new surgical devices or products. We also work with Intuitive Surgical in their training of robotic surgery techniques. When new devices or products are approved by the FDA, medical companies have to train the surgeons who will be using their product or devices prior to performing a live surgery. If they did not have our specimens to do this type of training, live animals would be used instead. We provide an opportunity for people to choose another way to be an anatomical donor. It is the choice of an individual or family member to donate someone's body to BioGift. Many times I hear family members telling us their loved one wanted to help in any way they can. They always wanted to donate their body after they did not need it any longer. With their selfless act of donation, many individuals will benefit from these medical devices, products, or new surgical techniques and obtain a better quality of life. We do not object to regulations that make sense and support House Bill 3345-A. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee would have.
Let's go ahead with the final testimony and then open it up for questions.
Thank you, Chair Monis-Anderson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordeman. I'm a funeral director from Albany, and I represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, which represents funeral homes and funeral directors from throughout the state. Knowing that you have my testimony close by, as well as being on the record from the House side with testimony there, and Representative Hoyle kind of setting the stage, I won't go through the entire testimony, but I will. There are a couple of points that I really did want to get on the record today. That is that the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, or OFDA, believes that any entity that takes possession of deceased human remains in the state of Oregon should be held to a standard of accountability that state oversight can provide, just as all funeral homes, funeral directors, crematories and cemeteries are currently, and that Oregonians deserve to know that they are trusting their loved ones to organizations and entities that are compliant not only with Oregon law, but also to the ethics of an industry that provides full disclosure and transparency to Oregon's consumers. This relatively new aspect of our industry, the non-transplant anatomical research recovery organizations, the two that have been referred to today, from all indications, are extremely professional and above board with everything that they do. The funeral director's concern is that without some sort of oversight, it will open the door for other companies to come into the state that might not be as reputable and might not be as professional in how they go about their business. And we think that having the protection of state oversight in this arena relinks that chain where we feel that the links have been broken a little bit. The citizens of Oregon, we believe, deserve the oversight as well as the leverage that 3345 can provide, and we strongly encourage its passage. Thank you.
Great. How many specimens do you have? I mean, are there hundreds, or is it a minimum amount? And I visited your facility.
Right.
And how many
for the
physicians do you have at a time that?
At our facility, it all really depends upon what type of course. We've had as few as two or three up to as many as 40. So it varies, depends on what type of training is going to be taking place.
And what's the most common training?
Minimally invasive surgery techniques.
But what organs are you using?
Well, we use a cadaver, so it's
everything.
It can be anything.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other discussion?
All right.
Thank you
very much. We will wait as soon as, are you working with Sandy with the amendment? So as soon as you get it, you'll reschedule it. All right. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing, House Bill 3345. And I think we are done for the day. We're adjourned.